Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miro Board. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miro Board?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online, at the same time.
Correct. Next. You need the team to act on feedback fast, so you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks instantly.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people running actually enjoyable and actionable retros in Miro. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to All Things Therapy with Lisa Tahir, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hello there. And welcome to All Things Therapy. I'm your host, Lisa Tahir. If you have not listened in before, I am a licensed clinical social worker. I practice as an intuitive psychotherapist. Additionally, I am certified in EMDR and as a Reiki Level 2 healing practitioner. I have physical offices in both New Orleans and Los Angeles, and I'd love for you to reach out to me if you would like to work together. I am happy to do a complimentary call by phone. I also conduct sessions worldwide through phone, Skype, and FaceTime. And you can go to my website to learn more at nolatherapy.com. It is the abbreviation for New Orleans, Los Angeles Therapy, and I invite you to join my email list so that when my book launches in the fall of 2020 with Inner Traditions Publisher, I'm able to get you information about it. I have spent the last 3.5 years writing about our core wounds and healing those wounds through empathy and self-forgiveness. So it's a deep dive into core wounding, it's healing, utilizing various modalities and methods that have really helped me in my life. So go to nolatherapy.com, give your email. There are links to my social media there on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can find me at Nola Therapy, and I'd love to connect with you. I have enjoyed the emails I've received. Thank you for them. Thank you for subscribing and sharing and rating this podcast on iTunes, iHeartRadio, Google Play. I ask that you please keep doing that, and I'll keep doing the show. This is episode 170, and today I have a guest that I'm personally very excited to interview because of his work. We will be in just a few moments with Dr. Robert T., like Tom Mueller. He is a trauma therapist, a psychologist. He's trained at Harvard University. I'll back up a bit. Currently is a professor of clinical psychology at York University in Toronto and in private practice. He is a fellow for the International Society for the Study of Trauma and Dissociation. Pardon me for hiccuping today over my words. He's an international speaker, a best-selling author of the book Trauma and the Avoidant Client. He's the editor of the Trauma and Mental Health Report, and you can find his blog on Psychology Today. It's called Talking About Trauma. And today, specifically, we are delving into Dr. Robert T. Mueller's most recent book, Trauma and the Struggle to Open Up, from avoidance to recovery and growth. And in this book, Dr. Muller talks about the use of attachment theory in trauma therapy as it relates to the therapeutic relationship between client and therapist with the end goal of promoting trust, recovery, and growth. So with that, I'm going to welcome you to the show. Welcome, Rob. Thank you for being with us.
Great. I'm really happy to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. I emailed you earlier about how much I have enjoyed your book, being a trauma therapist myself, and all that I am expecting to learn during our time together, since this has been your passion for 20 years. Where do you want to start us with today on this journey?
Ooh. If you press play, I can just talk for hours and hours.
One of the things I had asked, if you could just kind of initially share with us about the different attachment styles, so we're all working from the same baseline of knowledge.
Sure. That's a really good place to start. Attachment is a really important concept in trauma because trauma really affects people's attachments. It has an impact on how people engage in their relational world. And that's really what attachment is. It's the way in which, the regularly occurring way in which a particular individual engages in their interpersonal world, especially when there's intimacy, when there's vulnerability. Mm-hmm. And so people have different styles or attachment orientations, depending on a mix of things, such as their family and how their family dealt with emotions, whether or not they have a trauma history, et cetera. And those things have a big impact on how somebody engages in their relational world, whether they felt safe in their home environment. So there are four fundamental styles of attachment. And I'll just mention that these are different categories, and the secure attachment style is the first of the categories. And the category of secure attachment style refers to an individual feeling that they are secure in their interpersonal relationships. They feel that they can make choices where they don't worry tremendously about they don't feel a sense of insecurity. They feel more confident in their relationships. They're able to be vulnerable with others. The avoidant attachment style reflects the person who's really uncomfortable with emotions, tends to turn their attention away from vulnerability, and they have a lot of difficulty with being able to be vulnerable in relationships. The preoccupied attachment style, the third category, reflects somebody who's quite insecure, feels often a sense that they're preoccupied by past hurts. They're often very anxious. So that's sort of anxious attachment. They feel anxious in relationships. They're often indecisive about what they want. So it's very very difficult for them to engage in their relational world. And then the fourth category, the disorganized or unresolved attachment category, that reflects individuals who have really a lot of difficulty in even having a strategy to deal with relationships. They tend to go back and forth with different strategies in relationships, and they often have they often feel very fearful in relationships. They're often scared that they're going to be abandoned. So those are the four main categories. Sometimes they talk about three categories. Depends on the research study, the three or four categories that people talk about. But those are the main attachment categories.
Okay, thank you for that.
No problem.
So in talking about trauma affecting attachment, which impacts our ability to connect, can you tell us about, in your book, what you give a lot of case studies, a lot of examples that I enjoyed reading, because I think it brings the work to life. And okay. So kind of where would you like to start there with us?
One thing that I think is really important that I talk about in the book, and it's very fundamental to trauma therapy, is the idea of safety And what I talk about in the book is the idea that until you have a sense of safety in the therapeutic relationship, so if you're a therapist and you're working with people who have trauma histories, if they don't feel safe in the relationship with the therapist, then they're not going to really be able to do psychotherapy. And you might think, well, of course, who wants to feel afraid of their therapist? I'm not talking about safety in that kind of obvious sense. What I mean is that people get triggered really easily with the therapist, because with the therapist, what happens is they start talking about something vulnerable, let's say, you know, maybe something from the past, something in their family, etc. And then they start feeling anxious that the therapist is maybe judging them, or they feel that they don't deserve to waste the therapist's precious time, or they feel that the therapist is responding to them just like everybody else has. And people often project onto the therapist certain feelings and anxieties, and then they feel unsafe. They no longer feel that connection or trust with the therapist. And this can be very subtle. And so in the book, I talk about how there are many subtle ways that people will project these feelings onto the therapist and then all of a sudden not feel safe in the relationship. And you might wonder, I don't understand, with this client, we were doing so well, we were working, we were making progress, and all of a sudden, the last 2 or 3 weeks, he's been so defensive. I haven't seen that kind of defensiveness in months. I don't understand. So you might wonder to yourself, is there something that happened between the two of you that led the person to feel maybe judged or maybe something? You know, not that you did anything wrong necessarily, but sometimes these things are subtle when people have trauma histories. And so being attentive to those subtle things that happen in the relationship that lead to the person to feel unsafe, that's very important. And that's an important part of the process that I talk about in the book.
And it is an important, a very important stage that I found in my work we kind of go back to as needed with establishing safety, establishing trust, that it might be established. And as the story is being retold, as it's being remembered and shared, and the feelings, the transference happens, that you might need to kind of take a few steps back to reestablish trust, offer some reassurance, explore, you know, what's coming up for you around this. And I think that's such an important kind of process in trauma therapy, that containing of the emotions that our clients are having and demonstrating. And then our countertransference reactions to them when our stuff gets triggered, our traumas, and how we deal with that.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm really glad you raised the question of our traumas, because therapists who have been through, like, if you're doing trauma therapy, it's so helpful to be either in therapy yourself or to have been through therapy, preferably to have some kind of supervision group that you go to. So having a group of, so I meet every month with a group of trauma therapists at a hospital here in Toronto, Mount Sinai Hospital, and we go through our cases and we talk about difficulties and we talk about our feelings, and more than anything, we talk about the countertransference, what gets raised in us when we're working with someone, when we're really blocked and not making progress. Very often, something has gotten stirred in us, and we're not always conscious of it. And so getting some help from an external, you know, someone from the outside to say, okay, hey, you know, I know this about you. How does this fit? You know, that, or whatever. Someone who you trust, of course.
Cause yes.
You know, a little bit like being in therapy, right? So you have to have a trusting relationship with these people. You have to for sure have that. And if you have that, it can be so helpful to go through that together. Because that countertransference can really get in the way with trauma therapy.
And I see your book, Rob, dealing with the therapeutic relationship, and it caused me to think about intimacy and romantic relationships and how our traumas can be reenacted, can be triggered and stimulated in the intimate relationship setting. And it's navigating that in similar ways with establishing safety, with reassurance and such, and how, you know, the avoidance of intimacy plays out sometime when one is dating, you know, looking for a partner, and then even when they are partnered and navigating that.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Yeah. Like with, in my first book, Trauma and the Avoidant Client, I focused a lot specifically on that issue of avoidant attachment. And, that can also be really tricky. So for sure, it gets played out in intimate relationships. That's where we really see avoidant attachment in all its kind of most powerful forms. When people have then, you know, when they try to partner up and they struggle because they feel, for example, you know, why is my girlfriend or why does my boyfriend always have to raise these issues and talk about everything? I can't stand all this talking about stuff. You know, why can't we just, you know, and that's where it really comes out. And where you sometimes get these mismatches where you have one person who's a real talker, really focused on feelings, and another person who, you know, wouldn't know a feeling if it, you know, hit them in the head, and so then they're in a relationship and they struggle, right? I mean, they really can get into a lot of conflict. I also noticed that when I saw with avoidant attachment in particular, therapists who I often find that therapists are either securely attached or anxiously attached. I mean, that's just something that I find in my supervision experience. It's very rare, but I do sometimes see therapists who are avoidantly attached. Mm-hmm. The trick with that, if you're someone who struggles with feelings and you're a therapist, it's not to say that you can't do therapy. You can, but it just means doing work in your own therapy to become more comfortable with the expression of feelings. Because if you're doing trauma work, that can be a challenge. So, you might be inclined to want to kind of wrap things up. And if you do that with someone who's really always been invalidated in their life, they've always, you know, whatever trauma they had, people didn't want to listen to them, that person might once again feel as if you're telling them shut up, even if that's not your intention at all, like even if that's not what you're intending to do, but they may feel it that way. So you want to pay attention in your own therapy or in your own supervision, if you have a good supervisor, to the idea of getting comfortable with feelings and being able to get more comfortable with feelings so that you can be validating with your trauma clients.
And I definitely echo what you're saying, Rob, about anyone listening that's doing trauma therapy to really be involved in your own therapeutic process. I have in my 20-year career been involved in therapy to help when those issues are raised for me with clients and personal others in my life. That it's there's so many layers. I've learned there's just so many layers to unraveling trauma. And you know, we tend to say, for instance, going back to your book and establishing safety with our clients. And then the next phase, as Dr. Judith Herman talks about, and as you speak about and others, is the stage of remembrance and sharing the stories, you know, with being seen, being heard, really being able to give voice to those stories and unraveling, where you talk about the family secrets compounded with family loyalty. And anyone that grew up in a house with trauma, that there's this compelling drive not to say anything, like you just don't want to think about it. You just want to shut it down. And yet you want to also shout it out, you know, and like let the world know. But there's family loyalty. Can you talk to us some about this stage, kind of this mid phase of working once some safety is established and you're really in the heart of the material?
For sure. So let me talk about the phase, and then also get back to family secrets. So the issue of opening up, and which is the subject of my book, Trauma and the Struggle to Open Up. Why? Because it really is a struggle. I mean, it really feels scary to start to share when you've gotten used to the idea that safety is done by shutting up, by keeping secrets. And I don't mean to say that in a critical way. People mm-hmm. learn to do what they need to do to survive. And sometimes that really means shutting up, and because it was dangerous to open up. And if you said this or that in the family, you would be perhaps mocked, or you would be trivialized. Your words would be trivialized, or you would be seen as disloyal to the family. And so people learn to keep family secrets because it works, because mm-hmm. it's safe for them to do that, and it becomes a way of coping. So it's a process reaching a point where you can start to open up. Now, of course, trust is really important. We talked about safety in the relationship. If you have some time where you're working with someone and you're able to build that trust and build a sense of safety in the relationship, then they do, in fact, people want to tell their story. There's a mm-hmm. people, even if it's scary, holding on to a secret is a horrible burden. It's so painful to sit with this alone, this stuff, painful, ugly, sometimes story that you feel guilty maybe about certain aspects of it, or you feel stupid, you know, why didn't I fight back, or why didn't I do this? Mm. Or, you know, people say all kinds of things to themselves and feel horrible about their own story. So opening up means that once you start doing that, you start to worry. Does the therapist think I'm an idiot? Does the therapist think, you know, is he or she judging me? Do I sound so stupid, somebody might say. I mean, I've had clients say this, you know, as I say this, you know, they might say, I sound so dumb. It's, you know, and I stop and I say, help me understand how it's sounding to you. And we sort of examine, we explore that a little bit. So it becomes a real process, the whole opening up and how they feel about themselves when they start to. But if you're able to help them weather that process, and I do have some good strategies in the book on how to do that, how to help people weather that process, as they begin to share, what people do is they engage in what Judith Herman said was a mourning process. They begin to mourn losses. They begin to say, they begin to feel sad about things, that choices they made, you know, and aspects of life. For example, dealing with questions like, why me? Like, you know, they start asking themselves things like, why me? Or sometimes they might ask themselves, why not me? Like, why was it my sister who had to put up, and why was I spared? So they feel horrible guilt. Or yes. If it's PTSD in a combat situation, then again, I mean, they might feel, why not me? Why was, you know, my friend or my buddy who I fought alongside, why did he have to be killed by an improvised explosive device and I wasn't?
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
it's Miro! I've used those technical shape packs way too many times, and stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done! Is it...
Miro! Easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it!
Join over 60 million people creating creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first three boards for free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.
Hey everyone, it's Billy Morrison and Ozzy Osbourne here. Our new show, The Madhouse Chronicles, is dropping this April. Join us as we watch and react to the maddest internet clips. What do we discuss, Ozzy?
Drugs, rock and roll, aliens, all that kind of shit.
Drugs, rock and roll, aliens, and all that kinds of shit. Visit OsbourneMediaHouse.com for early access. What do you say? Do you think it's the wildest show on the internet?
Oh.
You're in the madhouse now.
So people then struggle with those questions and they start to face losses. You know, the loss of the sense that the world is always going to be a fair place. Of course, we all know this, but deep down, we operate on a daily basis with a fantasy that the world is going to be safe. I imagine I'm going to walk out of my office today and I'll get home okay and everything will be all right. I operate with this fantasy, with this assumption, this illusion about life. And when you've had trauma, you have to, in some ways, grapple with the notion that, you know, you've lost some sense of safety in the world.
Yes.
You've lost a certain illusion about the world, that people are fundamentally caring,
good,
loving.
Yeah.
You know, people are, you face these losses that those of us who have been fortunate enough not to have these traumatic experiences don't yet have to face. And when you've had trauma, you have to face these things. And so it's tough. It's painful work. And so for the therapist, helping people sit alongside those losses, slowly working with them, listening, not making assumptions, because you may think that this is what the person lost, you know, let's say loss of childhood. And maybe they lost that, but maybe they also lost something else that's more poignant for them, so, or relevant for them. So, yeah, I mean, sitting with those losses, that's a big part of this sharing process that you have.
It is. You know, Rob, there is a section of your book where you shared about a client you worked with, and I had a surprisingly large emotional reaction to it. And it's the situation, the female client whose mom would leave intermittently for, say, a few weeks at a time. And on this one occasion, and I'm paraphrasing it, she told your client and the brother, I believe, you know, I'm leaving. They're like, where are you going, mom? Oh, I'll be back soon. And her father got really angry. Why did you let her go? You know, don't you see what's happening? And your client was so young and her mother never came back. She just left. And as I read that, I started to feel such a high level of distress inside of my body, like over-identifying with your client and over-identifying with her story. And I had to take a moment and ask myself, like, what is coming up here? You know, this was not your experience. And when I thought about it a bit more deeply, I reflected upon it actually was my experience in a different way that I've never viewed a trauma that happened to me when I was 19 and my mother kicked me out of the house unexpectedly and sold all of my belongings. And I've always viewed, I've been in lots of therapy to work through this. I have a relationship with my mom now. I had always viewed it as she put me out. She cast me out like she didn't want me. But not until I read that portion of your book where I realized she actually left me, just like that mother left her children and moved. Like, I had never seen it from the aspect of my own mother left me and I had to start fending for myself. So I'm grateful, as deeply upsetting as it was in the moment to read that section of your book, that it helped me see kind of a core wound I hadn't quite noticed yet, that now I can heal and move forward, move beyond it, and integrate that loss and use it. So do you find that as well, like in your work? Yeah. So I just wanted to share that with you and our audience.
Yeah, no, thank you, Lisa. I think what you're raising is so true and so common for people who do this kind of work, that you find these themes in what your clients are telling you or what you're reading about that you connect with, and you want to pay attention to those themes, just like you did. I mean, I really like the way you said, I had to stop, and ask myself what's going on for me, which is just a beautiful way of putting it. That is what Peter Fonagy would say, the British psychologist Peter Fonagy would call mentalizing. When you stop and you ask yourself, what's going on for me right now? What am I experiencing? It's a question that focuses inward.
Yes.
It's not a blaming others kind of question. It's a what's going on for me internally? What's going on? And what am I, is there something I'm getting triggered by? Is there something that's going on for me that's leading me to feel this way? I'm feeling a particular way that's familiar, but maybe I hadn't expected it. So that's a mentalizing question. Mentalizing is a very important aspect of trauma work. It's looking inside. It's asking yourself, what's going on for me as a therapist? And when you do that, you can help your clients. You know, you can help them mentalize what's going on for them. You know, that's an important piece of the book as well, which is helping people deal with triggers, both the therapist and clients, right?
Yes.
So, yeah. And for sure, for me, I also do get triggered by certain things. I mean, for me, I think one of the most powerful triggers I had was, this was a client, not a client I saw, but a client that a colleague of mine saw, and we were talking about the case because I was helping, as part of my co-supervision group. And I found that when my colleague talked about this case, it just, I had trouble sleeping nights when that client, and so this was a case of, so my colleague's client who had lost a child due to a drowning, and the story itself was just horrible, but I think what was so hard was the effect it had on the client and the effect it had on my colleague. And then just hearing the story, so that was an example of vicarious traumatization. But
yes,
boy, was I triggered by that case. I mean, I think that's probably my biggest fear is, I think one of my biggest fears in the world is losing a child in some way, losing one of my children. So I've got three adult kids. And so that idea of losing them in some tragic sort of accident, it's a really powerful fear of mine. And so that, boy, was I triggered by that case. And I really,
absolutely,
think, you know, what was it that made me feel so vulnerable? What were my, what were my anxieties about that? What were my worries? You know, so yeah, thank you. Yeah. For sure. I mean, I also get triggered by certain
yourself.
Cases. Yeah. Yeah.
So we are going to do a quick commercial break, and I'll bring you right back on, Rob, in just a few moments. Yes. Okay. So to those of you listening, my sponsor this month is BetterHelp. They are a secure online therapy system where you can schedule and book sessions via phone, video, and text and email through their portal. You communicate through their platform, which is HIPAA compliant and secure, and you can address issues as varied as depression, stress, and anxiety to family conflicts, LGBT issues, self-esteem, and grief. And as my sponsor, they are offering you a 10% discount on your first month to try them out. That code is betterhelp.com/ATT, which stands for All Things Therapy. They are affordable, and they do offer financial aid available if you qualify. You can schedule as soon as within 24 hours. It's professional, affordable. I worked with them as a practitioner 5 years ago when I first went out to Los Angeles and got licensed in California. So if face-to-face therapy doesn't feel like it's an option for you, it's better to get help rather than not. So BetterHelp, check them out, betterhelp.com/ATT for a 10% discount on your first month.
Indeed, listening is the new reading. With Audible, you can listen to an unlimited amount of books at home, in your car, at the gym, anywhere on the go. With over 180,000 audiobooks to choose from. For you, the listener of All Things Therapy, Audible is offering you a free audiobook download and a month-long subscription for you to try them out. Visit audibletrial.com/allthingstherapy now and enjoy.
Yourself and friends find a purpose in life,
then you are in the right place and be a part of the crowdfunding campaign of patreon.com/allthingstherapy
with Lisa Tahir as she initiates a one-on-one interaction with inspiring authors, healing experts, and spiritual directors.
Join the League of Heroes of this generation by contributing your quota between $1 up to $100 per month
at patreon.com/allthingstherapy.
Let's make the world free of suicide, poverty, depression, and in all, make the world a better place for everyone.
Welcome back. If you're just joining in, I am Lisa, your host, and today I'm with Dr. Robert T. Muller. He is professor of clinical psychology at York University in Toronto, as well as in private practice. And today we're discussing his book, Trauma and the Struggle to Open Up, From Avoidance to Recovery and Growth. So, Rob, I feel like, you know, we've really set the stage around trauma causing a rupture in attachment, causing a disruption in relationships and a sense of safety and trust, and how important that is to establish in the therapeutic relationship in the beginning and ongoingly. I also really like in your book where you talk about moving beyond the trauma by integrating the realities of your past, trauma and identity. And I wonder if you could speak to us about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So I talk about identity in the book because it's a topic that I find a lot of trauma therapy books just don't talk about. One important aspect of the identity piece of trauma is that when you've gone through trauma therapy, it actually has an impact on how you see yourself and your place in the world. And so that's identity, you know, your sense of who you are and your sense of your the world and your place in it. And so we talk about post-traumatic growth when we think about the identity changes that happen through trauma, through trauma therapy, sorry. Now, nobody wants to say, and I think it's true, that of course, if you've been through trauma, you know, you don't want to be in a situation where you say to people, oh, don't worry, look on the bright side, you know, you're going to grow from this experience.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody who's been through trauma would say, you know what, no, thank you, I'd rather not have had this happen. So, you know, you want to be very thoughtful about that, that it's not a kind of a minimizing, you shouldn't take as a therapist a minimizing stance and say, you know, oh yeah, well, you know, you're going to grow from the experience. It's more just that when people go through therapy, what therapists have started to discover is that there is this thing that happens, and that is that people start to think about themselves differently. And so so one of the things that happens is changes in identity. And so, for example, there should be through trauma therapy a greater sense of self-determination. Mm-hmm. People often, when they've been through trauma, they feel that they have no agency in the world, no ability to affect change. If you're working with, for example, a rape survivor, you know it would be helpful, it is helpful, when they are able to do some assertiveness training work with you in therapy, and they feel they have a greater sense of agency. They have a greater sense of control over their own safety. You do this, you know, when you're working with people who have been through bad relationships, you know, traumatic relationships, and you help them find a way to feel like they have the license to slow a relationship down. They have the license to say no, or to say, I'm interested in sex, but at a certain pace. This is the
pace
I'm with, and they can voice that interest. And so you see a greater sense of agency. And when people have that greater sense of, you know, agency or self-determination, whatever you want to call it, they feel more control. They feel a greater sense of a place in, you know, they feel a greater internal sense of control. So that's a positive thing that can come out of trauma therapy. Greater sense of dignity. So, you know, I often say to people, there's another piece of identity. I often say to people, you know, people say, do you think I should do this? Do I think I should do that? I say to them, think about what is the dignified thing for you? Have you been acting in a way that you feel is dignified? And if not, how can we make changes there? Because feeling that you have a sense of, so often when people have been through trauma, again, they feel kind of like they're a crappy person. I don't know how to say it nicer than that. That's how they feel. They feel like, you know, I was treated like a doormat. I'm worth nothing but being a doormat. That's what people often feel like. And so helping them refine a sense of dignity is really important. And then clarifying values is another piece of identity, helping them clarify the values that are important to them, because very often they have values shoved on them. You know, this is, you know, you should be like this. You should be religious, or you should be not religious, or whatever. You should, you know, these are the values you should have. And rather than what are the shoulds, thinking about what are my internal values? You know, what do I actually feel? And what's important to me from a value sense, from a sense of what's right and wrong in the world. And so, not to say that you can change the world, but you can help them clarify what their values are so they can live a little bit more in accordance with those values. And again, when people say, well, what do you think I should do? I'm like, okay, what are your values around this? Mm-hmm. It doesn't actually matter what my values are. I mean, I can tell you this or that, but it doesn't actually matter. What matters are what your values are. So those all help when you work, you know, those sort of three pieces, I find really help build a greater sense of a positive identity for people. And that's, I think, an important part of trauma work. And people find that they grow when you do that with them.
Rob, yes, I especially like this part of your book, because it's been my experience that we can easily get lost in the trauma and stay there potentially forever in the re-experiencing, the rehashing, and that the resulting disempowerment. And I just like so much where you talk about post-traumatic growth and moving beyond the trauma through integration and facing the reality. Yes, this was my past. What can I do now? Who would I like to become? And this identity piece, it's a redevelopment of our identity through an empowerment process that is refreshing, because that's what allows us to feel happy, for a trauma survivor to experience happiness and love and joy, knowing how to set those boundaries and move on the spectrum from avoidance to more security within themselves and in the world and their interpersonal relationships.
Yeah, 100%. Exactly. I mean, some of trauma work for sure is focusing on the past, and we have to understand and deal with and face the past in order to be able to move forward. But you also, you know, when you're doing trauma work, you don't want to lose sight of the person's present and future, and where do they see themselves heading? And that's a piece of the work as well. You can really start doing this. I mean, I think you do need to do a lot of safety work. So
yes,
for your listeners, they should be aware that the identity chapter is the last chapter. So, you know, safety is earlier on, remembrance and mourning and talking about the experience. And then, as you know, if you're doing therapy with folks like this, as you're really moving along in the process, starting to do work around their identity is really enriching and really helps give the therapy some really nice other elements to it.
I like as well your vulnerability, where you shared about your parents are Holocaust survivors and that you grew up with that as kind of a background and a backdrop. And I wondered if you wanted to speak any of that, because you talk about it in your book very, very openly.
Yeah.
How they lost their childhoods and that effect upon you.
Absolutely. Yeah. As you mentioned, my parents were children during the Holocaust, which is a very unique experience. They didn't go to concentration camps because they were little kids. Their parents, my dad's dad was taken away, and then
yes,
his mom. I won't go into the details. My mom's parents were in hiding. But as kids, my mom and my dad, both separate, their families, what they decided to do was to have all the kids be separated. And so both my parents were in hiding and didn't know when their parents were going to come back. And so now it's a fascinating and terribly upsetting thing when I talk to them about this. But they felt both my parents felt so abandoned in these situations, not knowing where their families were, not knowing when they were going to come back. And it was so terrifying for them to be with near strangers. And that was their experience. And so that had a big impact on them and had a big impact on their approach to childhood. They both struggled in many ways to be able to parent when me and my brothers were younger. They really had a lot of difficulty. They didn't know, neither of them really knew how to be playful, vulnerable. They struggled with that.
Yeah.
And in time, I mean, it's interesting to see them now as they're both elderly, quite elderly, and they've changed a lot. I mean, it's been a lot of time, but still there is that fundamental fear of abandonment that's there. That's had an impact on me growing up and kind of what they were like as parents and how, kind of my sense of sometimes feeling like they were unavailable psychologically, like they just couldn't go to a vulnerable place. And I often wondered, I would see TV shows, I don't know, the Brady Bunch or whatever, the courtship of Eddie's father, these fathers who were so, available. And my dad just didn't know how to do that,
Mm-hmm.
I for sure feel that that's had indirectly, but definitely had an impact on my life. Yeah.
Thank you for sharing about that.
I'm happy to. Yeah.
Yeah, and I want to give listeners, before we end, on Twitter, you can be found at Trauma Report, on Facebook at Trauma and the Struggle to Open Up. And how else can listeners reach you if they wanted more information and such?
For sure. I have a blog with Psychology Today called Talking About Trauma. So that's one way. The other thing is, if they just Google my full name, Robert T. Muller, psychologist, or Dr. Robert T. Muller, M-U-L-L-E-R, and go to my Amazon author page, I have a bunch of different links there and information and resources as well. And my books are up there as well. So those are some ways to reach me. I can also be emailed. I don't mind that. I'm a university professor, and that's publicly available, so that's rmuller@yorku.ca. So that I don't mind being asked questions by email. So those are some ways to reach me.
Thank you. I really appreciate your time today with us and your work. It just got me, passionate again about trauma therapy, and I learned there were some things that were confirmed, and there was some new knowledge that I'm able to embrace and move forward with. So thank you.
Thank you, Lisa.
You're welcome. And I hope you have a wonderful rest of your day.
You too. You too.
Thanks. You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That concludes my show today with Dr. Robert T. Muller of York University, clinical psychologist and blogger on psychologytoday.com. Talking About Trauma is his blog. I want to thank you all for joining me today, and I look forward to being with you next Thursday. NOLATherapy.com on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, NOLATherapy.com for us to meet and work together. All my love to you. Bye-bye.
You're listening to All Things Therapy with Lisa Tahir. Only.